them and work in their hearts and lives. We thank you and bless you. Amen. So there's several chats I didn't get to. A Shabbat Shalom from Susanna and from Bob and Jan, and I think a few other Shabbat Shaloms too. I can't see all of them, but that's okay. We're going to start. This is Exodus chapter 30 through 34. This portion is called Ki Tisa. It has to do with the half shekel tax that was collected when the census was taken. The quote that the Rebbe begins this commentary with is this passage from Exodus 30. This they shall give a half shekel of the sacred shekel, 20 gerah is the shekel. When the Holy Temple stood in Jerusalem, each Jew would contribute an annual half shekel to the temple. The money was used to purchase the daily offerings brought in the Holy Temple on behalf of the entire community of Israel. The Torah is insistent that the contribution should consist of exactly half a shekel, repeating this requirement no less than three times in as many verses. And this is a quote, this they shall give a half shekel of the sacred, shekel. 20 gerah is the shekel, half a shekel, a contribution to God. The rich man shall not give more, and the pauper shall not give less than the half shekel to give a contribution for God to atone for your souls. Why half a shekel? We know that, as a rule, everything that is for the sake of God should be the best and most beautiful. When one builds a house of prayer, it should be more beautiful than one's own dwelling. When one feeds the hungry, one should feed them of the best and sweetest of one's table. Whenever one designates something for a holy purpose, one should sanctify the finest of one's possessions, as it is written in Leviticus 3, the choicest to God. For this reason, Torah law mandates in many cases that the object of a mitzvah, a divine commandment, must be tamim, whole. A blemished animal cannot be brought as an offering to God, nor can a blemished etrog. The etrog is that yellow citron that we use in the waving of the lulav on Sukkot. Nor can a blemished etrog be included in the four kinds taken on the festival of Sukkot. Even when this is not an absolute requirement, Torah law states that whenever possible, one should strive to fulfill a mitzvah with a whole object. For example, it is preferable to recite a blessing on a whole fruit or a whole loaf of bread rather than on a slice. Hence our use of two whole loaves at all Shabbat and festival meals. Why then does the Torah instruct that each Jew contribute half a shekel towards the temple service? The Torah's repeated reference to this contribution as a half shekel is all the more puzzling in light of the fact that in these very same verses, the Torah clarifies that a half shekel consists of 20 gerah. In other words, the amount contributed by each individual to atone for your souls was 10 gerah. 10 is a number that denotes completeness and perfection. The entire Torah is encapsulated within the Ten Commandments. The world was created with 10 divine utterances. God relates to his creation via 10 sefirot, divine attributes. And the soul of man, formed in the image of God, is likewise comprised of 10 powers. But instead of instructing to give 10 gerah, the Torah says to give a half of a 20 gerah shekel deliberately avoiding mention of the number 10 and emphasizing the half element of our contribution for God. So the prophets compare the bond between God and Israel to the union of a man and woman in marriage. Indeed, the symbolism of the half shekel contribution reflects the very essence of marriage. If each partner approaches the marriage with a sense of him or herself as a complete entity, they will at best achieve only a relationship between two distinct self-contained lives. Marriage, however, is much more than that. The Kabbalists explain that husband and wife are the male and female aspects of a single soul, born into two different bodies. For many years, these two half-souls live distinct and separate lives, often at a great distance from each other and wholly unaware of each other's existence. But divine providence contrives to bring them together again under the wedding canopy and accord them the opportunity to become one again, not only one in essence, but also one on all levels, in their conscious thoughts and feelings and in their physical lives. Marriage is thus more than the union of two individuals. It is the reunion of a halved soul, the fusion of two lives that are originally intrinsically one. We'll talk about this concept in a minute, but he goes on. To experience this reunion, each must approach his or her life together, not as a 10, but as a half. This half shekel consists of 10 gerah. Each must give all their all to the marriage, devoting to it the full array of resources and potentials they possess. But each must regard themselves not as a complete being, but as a partner, a part seeking its other part to make itself whole again. The same applies to our marriage bond with God. The human soul is a part of God above, a part that descended to a world whose mundanity and materiality conspired to distance it from its supernal or spiritual source. So even a soul who is in full possession of her 10 powers is still but a part. And even when God fully manifests the 10 attributes of his involvement with creation, he is still only partly present in our world. It is only when these two parts unite in marriage that their original wholeness and integrity is restored. To truly connect with God, we must contribute half of a 20 gerah shekel. We must give ourselves fully to him, devoting the full spectrum of our 10 powers and potentials to our marriage with him. And even as we achieve the utmost, in self-realization in our relationship with God, we must be permeated with a sense of our halfness, with the recognition that we, as he, are incomplete without the other. So this is one of the things that the Rebbe mentions in his essay. In other words, the amount contributed by each individual to atone for your souls was 10 gerah. The passage that this comes from is Exodus 30. The rich are not to give more than a half a shekel, and the poor are not to give less. When you make the offering to the Lord, notice it says to atone for your lives. And the word lives, that's the word used in the NIV, the literal word is souls, to atone for your souls. Receive the atonement money from the Israelites and use it for the service of the tent of meeting. It will be a memorial for the Israelites before the Lord. And again, this expression, making atonement for your lives. The Hebrew is lachaper al nafsho techem, to make atonement for your souls. There's another passage, which I'm sure you're familiar with, that also speaks of atonement in Leviticus 17. This is the New King James. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls. And then notice how this phrase concludes. It is the blood that makes atonement for your souls, right? So it's interesting because in the one passage, we read about the half shekel contribution given to the tabernacle when the census is taken of Israel's young men, the men between 20 and 50 who are capable of going to battle. But in this passage in Leviticus, it speaks of the blood, the requirement that blood is shed for the forgiveness of sins or the atonement for our souls. So there is a comment from one of my commentaries that speaks to this. It's a good statement regarding what's actually going on with the half shekel. The precise reason for taking a census is not given. Perhaps it was to obtain a register of citizens for public duties in the Lord's service. Previously, in chapter 13, verse 13, it states that the firstborn son belonged to God and had to be redeemed by a sacrifice. Likewise, all firstborn belonged to God, and he accepted the tribe of Levi in lieu of all the firstborn. Verse 12 extends the principle. The word for ransom or atonement, kafar, signifies to deliver or redeem by a substitute. In this case, the substitute was money by taking a census. Usually a census was equivalent to mustering troops, and that is why it was so dangerous in David's case from 2 Samuel 24. It is clear, however, that those who were numbered under the proper circumstances would be under divine protection. So the shekel is mentioned in 21:32. A half shekel in verse 13 would be about one-fifth of an ounce. This tax was to be paid by adults of military age. The fact that the rich were to give the same amount as the poor shows that it was not how much one had that obtained atonement for his life. The proceeds from the census tax were to be used by the Levites in their service for the Lord and were also able to serve as a memorial for the Israelites, right? So the passage that we read earlier is that each individual must pay the Lord a ransom for his life at the time he is counted. And that's what this half shekel is intended to satisfy. If you look at this passage in Ezekiel 38, it talks about the half shekel contribution to the tabernacle and the silver. The shekel was made up of silver. And the silver that was collected for the construction of the tabernacle and what it was used for. The 100 talents of silver were used to cast the basis for the sanctuary and for the curtain, right? So the tabernacle had four walls that were suspended in place by these cast silver bases, and the shekels were used to make the silver hooks for the posts, right, that the coverings were attached to. So the coverings, there were three coverings, and they were put over the tabernacle and then secured by these hooks. There's a interesting passage in Hebrews that also speaks to this. And it's in Hebrews 9, and I think a part of this passage is frequently overlooked in the way the passage is is understood. The author of Hebrews says, in fact, the law requires that nearly everything be cleansed with blood. And without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness, right? If you look at this passage in Revelation 13, all inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, that is, the Antichrist, all whose names have not been written in the Lamb's Book of Life, the Lamb who was slain from the creation of the world. So, before creation, according to this passage from Revelation 13, and it's mentioned in three or four other passages as well, the Messiah is slain before the foundation of the world, before the creation of the universe. So it has a timeless quality to it, an eternal quality to it. But there are other passages that actually speak of the blood of the Messiah being shed in this world, in space, in time. This passage in Isaiah 53 describes it. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and to cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life an offering for sin, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. So the Messiah suffers, he dies, he sheds his blood. That shed blood is the basis for the redemption, for the atonement, for the forgiveness that God facilitates in the Messiah, right? But the atonement money is referred to that way because it facilitates atonement too. And in the commentary we read earlier, the atonement it seems to facilitate is the recognition that as each individual who is counted gives a half a shekel to God as a part of the census that is taken, that half shekel and the numbering of those people, there is a recognition that the Levites have taken the place of those people, right? So a substitute has been made, and that's the subject of the expression with regard to the atonement, that a substitute has been made, and the tribe of Levi is substituted for the firstborn among the children of Israel. At any rate, I want to move on and talk about a couple of other things. He mentions in the essay that the entire Torah is encapsulated within the Ten Commandments. The world was created with ten divine utterances. God relates to his creation via ten sefirot, or divine attributes. And the soul of man, formed in the image of God, is likewise comprised of ten powers, right? So I wanted to express briefly what some of these things are, because he makes references to things and it's important that we understand what he's referring to. So the Ten Commandments are obviously recorded in the book of Exodus and in the book of Deuteronomy, and you're familiar with them. They are a summary of the entire Torah. The ten utterances with which the world was created are identified in Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, and the Vilna Gaon lists the ten utterances. So the ten utterances are mentioned in Pirkei Avot, and the Vilna Gaon, who lived in the 18th century, he lists the ten utterances as follows. In the beginning of God's creating the heavens and the earth, but it's connected to this passage in Psalm 36, by the word of the Lord, the heavens were made. So number two is, God said, let there be light. Number three is, God said, let there be a firmament. Number four, God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let dry ground appear. The fifth statement is God said, let the land sprout vegetation. The sixth is that God said, let the luminaries in the firmament, let there be luminaries in the firmament of the heaven. Seven, God said, let the water teem with living creatures. Eight, God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures. Nine, let us make mankind in our image. And ten, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it, they will be yours for food. Okay? So, I want to move on to the ten Seth he wrote. These are identified in the Kabbalah. If you look at the next page, you'll see a diagram. If you've ever opened a book on Kabbalah, on Jewish mystical literature, you will see this designation. And it's important because this illustration, this diagram, reveals what are regarded as the 10 attributes or characteristics of God, but also 10 characteristics or attributes of man as well. So the first is Chochmah, which is wisdom. Bina is understanding, and Da'at is knowledge, right? Chochmah, Bina, Da'at. Wisdom, understanding, knowledge. By the way, for those of you who have ever gone to Chabad's website and done some research regarding a question you might have about Jewish practice or some theological issue, the Hebrew word Chabad is an acronym. It is made up of these three words. Chochmah is the Ch of Chabad. The Bina is the B in the middle of Chabad. And the Da'at is the Dalet or the D sound at the end, right? So Chabad is an acronym made up of the words wisdom, understanding, knowledge. We move on with the others. Chesed is kindness or grace, often translated loving kindness. Gevura is strength. Tiferet is beauty. Netzach is victory. Hod is splendor. Yesod is foundation, and Malchut is kingship. So, for example, when Yeshua spoke about the Malchut HaShemayim, the kingdom of heaven, this is one of the aspects of God's character or nature, attributes that he was referring to, right? The manifestation of God's presence in his, you know, the sovereign rule in the lives of the people who make up the kingdom. I just want to explain briefly the Sephirot. This is not going to become a class on Kabbalah. It's not my objective to do that. I just want you to understand where some of these references come from. The Sephirot are 10 modes or attributes through which God manifests himself. The Sephirot are not God, but they are the medium through which specific qualities and attributes can be ascribed to him. The word Sephirah is related to the verb lesaper, which means to express or communicate. This implies that the function of a Sephirah is to express a certain attribute. It is also related to the word sapphire. In Hebrew, sapir, a sapphire is a gemstone that is brilliant and illuminating, implying that the function of a Sephirah is to give light. Combining these two concepts, one may say that the Sephirot have two basic functions. One has lights or luminaries that serve to reveal and express, and another as vessels that limit and define the light so that specific qualities are manifest. The Sephirot may be compared to the two hands of a king. Sometimes the king operates with his right hand and sometimes with his left hand. Ultimately, it is the king himself who is acting through the use of his hands, right? So that is not a particularly thorough explanation, but it does give you a sense of how this works. So if you have an interest, this is something you can kind of explore on your own, but you should be aware of the rabbinic injunction that a man or a person, a woman, should not study Kabbalah until they are at least 40 years old, right? But when rabbis speak of a man or a woman not studying Kabbalah until they're 40, you have to appreciate the fact that at age 40, they have been studying the Torah for 35 years, right? So it's not something that they start in adulthood. They learn Hebrew, they study Torah, beginning with the book of Leviticus, from the age of 5. And they study it every day of their lives for as long as their lives last, right? So by the time someone is 40, they have a good foundation or basis of Torah with which to, you know, kind of contemplate some of the issues that come up here. Also, from the 10 Sephirot, the soul derives its corresponding 10 soul powers, all of which have names identical to the Sephirot. So we are regarded as being imbued with various powers of the soul, abilities, attributes, that we obviously have a responsibility to tap, to express in our relationships with others. Okay? So moving on, the prophets compare the bond between God and Israel to the union of man and woman in marriage. Indeed, the symbolism of the hev shekel, contribution, reflects the very essence of marriage. And there are several passages that speak of this idea. One in Isaiah 54, "For your maker," God says to the people of Israel, "is your husband. The Lord Almighty is his name. The Holy One of Israel is your Redeemer. He is called the God of all the earth. The Lord will call you back as if you were a wife deserted and distressed in spirit, a wife who married young, only to be rejected, says your God. For a brief moment I abandoned you, but with deep compassion I will bring you back. In a surge of anger I hid my face from you, notice for a moment, but with everlasting kindness, eternal kindness, I will have compassion on you, says the Lord, your Redeemer." There's several passages that speak of this partnership, this connection between God and his people. If you look at this passage in Jeremiah, notice that this is what the Lord says at the end of verse 2. "I remember the devotion of your youth, how as a bride you loved me and followed me through a wilderness, through a land not sown," right? I mean, we've been studying the book of Numbers for years now, and frankly, I think the same thing every time I read this passage from Jeremiah 2. I don't really understand how God describes his relationship with the people of Israel in the wilderness, or describes Israel as a bride who loved me and followed me through the wilderness, right? I mean, there are many occasions in the wilderness when the people rebel against God. They turn against Moses. They They complain, they gripe about the provision that God is making for them. They complain about the fact that they have no water, no food, with the exception of the manna. What's this? Right? So it's an interesting description, but this is a characteristic on occasion of the way God describes his relationship with his people. You've heard that expression, love is blind. Well, it certainly is true in God's case with regard to his relationship with his people, Israel. And I can only say that I, for one, am eternally grateful that it's like that, right? At any rate, in Hosea chapter 2, in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband, and you will no longer call me my master. Thou, a bow and sword and battle, I will abolish from the land so that all may lie down in safety. And then God says to his people, Israel, I will betroth you to me forever, not temporarily, forever, right? So this is among the hundreds of passages that speak of God's eternal commitment to his people, and therefore should dismiss the theological perspective that God has rejected his people and raised up a church in his place, right? It goes on, I will betroth you in righteousness and justice, in love and compassion. I will betroth you in faithfulness, and you will acknowledge the Lord. So I kind of want to get to number 4 and talk about some of the things associated with 4 and 5, partly because of the way we understand the Rebbe's comments regarding the separation of the soul into a man and a woman, and then God's intention or objective of bringing them back together so that they can kind of be recombined in a way that they were at one time before their birth. Okay? Number 4, each must regard themselves not as a complete being, but as a partner, a part seeking its other part to make itself whole again. So, in Hebrew, there is a term for this. It's called beshert, right? You may be familiar with the word soulmate. A soulmate is someone with whom you have a intimate connection that you have probably been able to figure out some of the things that make up that connection, but there is a soul connection that is very hard to define, right? There's just a connection that exists between you and another person, between a man and a woman. So, in Jewish thought or Jewish theology, we talk about this idea of a soulmate, right? And this is one of the things that, as children, we're encouraged to find as we grow up, and we encourage our children to find their soulmate as well. But I do want to read you a comment regarding the idea of soulmate, in this particular case, from Focus on the Family, a Christian organization that I'm sure you're familiar with. Finding a soulmate, someone who will complete us, Gary Thomas is the author of this comment, says, the problem with looking to another human being to complete us is that, spiritually speaking, it's idolatry. We are to find our fulfillment and purpose in God. If we expect our spouse to be God to us, he or she will fail every day. No person can live up to such expectations, right? But obviously, Gary Thomas doesn't understand the concept that we've described in this essay, right? I mean, I can't think of a Jewish person on the planet who imagines that their husband or their wife is a substitute for God in their relationship with each other, right? That's obviously not what the Rebbe is referring to. What the Rebbe is referring to is an idea. The idea has to do with the fact that the soul is eternal. The spirit that has been breathed into us is alive. It's eternal, right? So, if the neshama, the breath that God breathed into mankind, is eternal, it means what the word eternal means. It's without time, right? So, it must mean, according to Kabbalistic thought, that the soul that makes up the individual, right, that determines who they are, what they're like, their characteristic, their qualities, you know, the way they understand things, right, that those things reflect an eternal state or condition, right? So it is thought that people are a soul in God's presence before they're assigned a body, right? But that's all this is in Hebrew. We don't think of a human being as a body, a soul, and a spirit. We think of them as having this eternal quality, right, which existed before their birth, and that they are born into a body, a male or a female body, right? So the soul is divided. Half is put into the woman, half is put into the man, and it is our quest as we age and contemplate marriage. It is our objective to find our soulmate, right? Some do, some don't. Obviously, much more could be said about that, but I want to move forward with a different idea as a result of making sense of this. If you look at the commentary of John Calvin, commentaries on the epistles of Paul the Apostle to the Corinthians, God is the source of both sexes, and hence, both of them ought with humility to accept and maintain the condition which the Lord has assigned to them. Let the man exercise his authority with moderation and not insult over the woman who has been given him as his partner, right? Now, it's interesting because Calvin uses the word partner to speak of a marriage between a man and a woman, but it will be obvious from the next sentence that he does not have the concept of partner in mind. Let the woman be satisfied with her state of subjection and not take it amiss that she is made inferior to the more distinguished sex. So the male sex is more distinguished, but you have to question on what basis is a comment like this made. Of course, Calvin would say it comes from the teaching of Paul. But I can tell you unequivocally that it does not come from the teaching of Paul. It comes from a misapplication and a misinterpretation of what Paul actually says, which sadly is quite common, right? Because people fail to recognize that Paul was a rabbi. He was thinking in Hebrew. He does not use words like they're used in Greek. He uses words like they're used in Hebrew, and he's trying to communicate biblical concepts and ideas. He's trying to communicate a Jewish worldview, a Jewish paradigm, not a Greek paradigm, even though he's writing in Greek. And fortunately for him, since he was writing to believers in synagogues, both Jews and Gentiles, who would have been trained in the way to understand his words, it would have made sense to them. Sadly, it doesn't make sense to many these days, but there are more and more people trying to come to terms with these things. The underlying idea that women are created by God to serve men as subordinates has produced a familiar subset of lies that has been taught from pulpits and in Sunday school classes and even in women's Bible studies taught by other women. Women are fit for cooking, cleaning, and childcare because they have a God-given inclination for domestic activities. Because women were created to serve her husband, a godly wife shouldn't pursue a career or place her career ambition above her husband's. And because Eve was given to Adam as his sexual partner, it is a wife's responsibility to fulfill her husband's sexual desires, even if she does not agree with his requests, right? I mean, I'm not sure how, from anything we've discussed so far, you can imagine that a woman is supposed to be a partner with her husband, right? But that's what the idea, the whole idea of the shared communicates, right? That a man and a woman, when they join together in marriage, represent a half shekel. And it is their combination, their connection to each other, that makes them whole in the way that God has designed. And by the way, when God created Adam, he didn't just create a man. He created mankind. It's unfortunate that English translations don't always render this correctly either. God created mankind on the sixth day, on the afternoon of the sixth day. Man doesn't appear as a man until God separates from mankind the woman, right? So the woman and the man are created at the same time when God divides them in much the same way that we just discussed, right? That the soul is divided in heaven before birth, but the original couple that this happened to was Adam and Eve, separated right after birth. They were created as mankind and become a separate man and a separate woman as a result of God's creative efforts on their part. The fact is that they're supposed to be in partnership with each other. A husband and a wife are supposed to be partners. A wife is not intended to be a sexual object. Her only objective is to bear children and to raise them until they're old enough, you know, for someone who is truly mature and responsible to take care of them, right? That's just not the way this works in Jewish thought. But if you look at this quote from Thomas Aquinas, his theology reflects the same idea. This is in his Summa Theologica, his treatise on man. It's a series of questions regarding theological issues. This is his treatise on man. The production of the woman, right? This is from Article 1, whether the woman should have been made in the first production of things. It was necessary for woman to be made, as the scripture says, as a helper to man, not indeed as a helpmate in other works, as some say, since man can be more efficiently helped by another man in other works, but as a helper in the work of generation. This can be made clear if we observe the mode of generation carried out in various living things, right? So the church fathers emphasize this role of women in marriage, right? The men are dominant. They're the ones with the authority. They are like a general in an army, and the wife is nothing more than a private that the general uses at his discretion for whatever purpose suits him, right? But that betrays or defies the concept of partnership and what a true partnership actually is. Woman was not made for man in the sense that she was made to serve him, but to complement him, so that together as partners they might realize God's creative, redemptive purpose in their lives. And look at the way these ideas are expressed in the rabbinic literature. Rabbi Yossi met the prophet Elijah and asked him, "It is written, I will make him a help. But how does a woman help a man?" Elijah, "If a man brings wheat, does he chew the raw wheat? If he brings flax, does he put on the green flax? Does not the woman bring light to his eyes and help him stand on his own two feet?" I mean, obviously, thank you. Obviously, it's the woman who grinds and bakes the wheat and spins and weaves the flax. Another passage from the tractate, these are both from the tractate in the Talmud on Levirate marriage. Rabbi Eliezer said, "Any man who has no wife is not proper. That is a whole man. For it is said, male and female created he them and called their name Adam." So if you look at the footnote, number 4, Genesis 5:2, Adam means man or mankind. Only when the male and female were united were they called Adam, were they called mankind. But the point here is similar, right? It's the idea that men and women complement each other. They both have skills and abilities and insights and sensitivities, whatever it is, whatever terms you want to use to describe the differences, right? A man who has no wife is not whole, because he brings a half shekel to the union, and the woman brings a half shekel to the union. And only together are they regarded as the whole that God intended them to be. And also from Baba Metzia, this is a tractate on civil legislation. People say, if your wife is short, bend down and whisper to her. Why? To solicit her counsel, right? Why would a man be interested in soliciting the counsel of his wife, right? Because in Jewish thought, she is regarded as having a sensitivity to spiritual things that often surpasses that of her husband, right? And many of the laws, for example, that apply to men and are regarded as time-bound laws, like the requirement to pray 3 times each day, are given only to men. Why aren't they given to women? Because the rabbis believe that women do not need to be instructed to pray. They pray naturally many times a day whenever the opportunity or the need arises, right? But men, on the other hand, we need the prompting to spend time with God, because it's easy for us to be so consumed with what it is that we're doing that we don't pay attention to some of these things. But the woman does, right? So a man should bend down and whisper to his wife to solicit her counsel. And one last idea. Even as we achieve the utmost self-realization in our relationship with God, we must be permeated with a sense of our halfness, with a recognition that we as He are incomplete without the other. This is kind of an interesting idea that even God is incomplete without us. And obviously, we would not describe God that way. But there are a couple of passages in which Paul, for example, describes us as fellow co-workers in God's service, right? In other translations, this word is the word for partnership. We partner with God in the work that He has called us to. And these words of Yeshua in John 14 speak of the greater things that we will do than those things that He did, right? Because He was going to the Father and we would, be anointed with God's presence, with God's Spirit. But the kind of remarkable thing here has to do with the fact that, God uses our hands to facilitate His will. He uses our feet to accomplish His objective. He uses our words, right, to comfort someone who is mourning or to rejoice with someone who, has an opportunity to rejoice about something. The kind of remarkable thing about it has to do with the fact that we get to contribute to God's ultimate objective, right, to see this universe become a place, that is ruled by God. And all of the principles that are embodied in the Torah being employed in people's lives in such a way that, that we experience a contentment and a peace in our relationships with God and with others that it's not possible to have otherwise. So it's nice to imagine that we get to play a role in whatever it is that God is doing in our lives. So I'm going to stop here and see if there are any comments or questions about what we've just discussed. Anybody? Rivka took her a minute to get on because of an issue she had with her computer. But Susanna joined us, and then mentioned she has to go. Great study. Thank you. And that's it. So any comments, questions before we go? Yeah.
I'll be loud enough.
Can you hear Mark? Yeah, maybe you can come over here.
Yeah, everybody. So with relationship to Christ's or the Messiah's time on this earth, does any of those things apply to his life in terms of having, I didn't think Jesus would have a soulmate.
Yeah.
And like with Paul as well. So it's kind of like.
Yeah, good question.
What are the exceptions to the rule?
Yeah, that's a great question. Mark asked a question about Yeshua, if whether or not he had a soulmate, and if whether or not he was married, or if there was an expectation that he would have been married, right? And the fact of the matter is that there probably was an example or an expectation in the community that he was married, right? He should have been married when he was 18. That's when men were thought to be married by. They could get married earlier than that. But if a man wasn't married by 18 or at the outside by the year 21, right, it probably would have been a bit of a stigma for a young man to deal with. But with regard to Yeshua, This is a controversial subject, comes up from time to time. It is often said that, you know, if Yeshua was going to fulfill the instructions that God gave, then he should have been married too. But you have to remember that his birth, his coming into this world was different from ours. In other words, Yeshua is a manifestation of God on earth. He was placed into a body of a child to facilitate this need to shed blood, which was done on the cross. But when he was created, right, his soul wasn't originally prepared with a female, with a female half, right? So that when they were born, one would have been assigned a male body, the other would have been assigned a female body, and then they would have had to have tried to find each other in their life because he wasn't born in the way that we are. So that would not have been true of him. There's no question that the vast majority of men and women in biblical times were married, right? But there are exceptions, and Yeshua seems to be one of them. And I think it has to do with the character of his birth, right? So, good. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Very good. Anybody else before we go? Yeah, that's a great question, too. The this obviously comes up whenever a conversation like this takes place, because when two people get married, this is not always true, but, you know, when two people get married and fall in love with each other, I think for the most part that they think or imagine or count on the fact that they are compatible in ways that will make for a long-term permanent relationship, right? I think most people who get married anticipate being married to that particular person for the rest of their lives. I mean, that obviously does not always happen. So, because that does not always happen, it kind of forces people to think through, to think through that relationship. But there's more to soul mateness than love or common interests. You have to remember that in biblical times, most marriages were arranged, right? In other words, people didn't meet their husband or their wife at work or at a social event, right? The marriage was arranged by parents, and the arrangement was designed to facilitate the drawing out of their particular child, the drawing out of the various qualities that that child have, and by the view that this person that they're going to be married to, either a man or a woman, right, that person had the ability to complement those qualities and to draw them out and to facilitate growth in them that might not be possible otherwise, right? So people typically did not get married because they fell in love with each other and loved each other. They got married because their parents believed that they had the right complementary qualities to make a life together, right? So that's the idea. Unfortunately, that is not what happens too often these days. By the way, it still occurs in the Orthodox Jewish community. Marriages are still arranged in an Orthodox Jewish community, and I don't know if all Chabad communities do this, but it is certainly done in some. And, you know, what percentage I couldn't say, but the fact of the matter is that there is a, it's not unheard of, but there is a very, very low divorce rate among Chabad Jews, for example, right? So when we go through a divorce, that's one of the things that we have to think through. You know, why did this happen? What happened? It seemed as though we were so compatible when we got married. And sometimes it's important for us to explore more deeply, you know, the reasons why we may have been attracted to each other and try to come to terms with what occurred, right, so that it doesn't happen again, right? But sometimes it does happen again, unfortunately, right? So I think the reason it happens the way it does is because we are not taught probably as well as we should be the things to look for in a mate, right? I think that there's this expectation that, you know, two people will meet, they'll fall in love with each other, they'll fall in love because they think of themselves as being compatible and they get married. And, right, I mean, when I was living in the Bay Area with Dolores, our closest friends were all couples that had been married for 40, 50, 60 years, right? And those relationships and what it took to make them work was just a tremendous thing to learn from, right? It was a wonderful, the connection with some of those people was really a wonderful thing to try to draw inspiration from and apply, you know, to my own life, for example, right? So, but it's complicated. Oftentimes people don't end up with their soulmate. And, you know, they do the best they can, and in some cases people succeed, you know, for a couple of decades, right? But there are other reasons why that's true too, right? So it has more to do with the relationship than compatibility. Yeah. It's a complex issue. David, did you want to follow up that with anything? Yeah, that's a great question. Because the voice prints are unique, the fingerprints are unique, and there are other qualities that are unique from person to person too. So it's an interesting idea to give some thought to. Yeah, I think in Hebrew thought, people are not a body, a soul, and a spirit. They're an inner being and an outer expression, right? So people are what they are on the inside. You know, the spirit, the soul, and then on the outside is what you see, what others see. So the closer the connection is between what's on the inside and what's on the outside, you know, that means that you're connected to someone or experiencing someone you know, more transparently than you might otherwise, right? So, yeah, good. What was the other comment? Yeah, I think that we probably would all agree that sometimes expectations get us into trouble, right? Yeah, I would say that that's true. I don't know that expectations should be dismissed entirely, right? But I do know that I do know many people, for example, struggle with expectations imposed upon them by their parents, right? Or by a husband or a wife or a sibling. It could be anybody, right? So, you know, that's something that we have to come to terms with as we kind of negotiate who we are and where we're going. Yeah, expectations can be a source of great conflict, right? But I don't know that they're entirely bad things. I don't think they're bad things entirely. I just think sometimes expectation is abusive, can be abusive. Yeah, good. Thanks, David. Appreciate those comments. Let me try my new trick here. Yeah, it works. Bob and Jen, Bob, you have a hand raised. You have a comment, question. Yeah, it does make sense. I would need to give that some more thought, but it's a good idea. And by the way, mazel tov on 48 years of marriage. And you know, what's kind of, you know, whatever the circumstances were that initially brought you together, neither one of you probably imagined that that was to take place that day before it occurred, right? So these are the kinds of things that the Lord orchestrates. We have very little to do with it, but he knows what's going on, and he knows why the things happen that happen, right? So it's kind of nice to hear a story like that where God obviously, you know, connects pieces together to make a whole, which it sounds like he has certainly done that with you. So that's kind of a nice thing. The other insights are good too. The idea that there is no marriage in heaven, right? So that does, that may lead to the idea or to the notion that, that when we are reunited at the end of our lives, you know, we will be reconnected with that soulmate. You know, that's kind of an interesting thought. So I'll have to give that some more consideration. But it's an interesting idea. So good. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate those comments. Anybody else have a comment to make? Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you, Keith. I think that we do tend to, and frankly, part of it has to do with the description of the creation of woman, right? That God caused Adam to fall into a deep sleep, and he took one of Adam's ribs and fashioned the woman out of one of Adam's ribs, right? But I've said this many, many times. Hebrew describes things the way they look, not necessarily the way they actually are. So Hebrew favors descriptions of things that helps us relate to them, right? Helps us understand them and relate to them. And it's not necessarily the way something actually occurred or, you know, a process actually took place. The description of creation in the first 31 verses of Genesis, right, there are many things described that help us appreciate how our universe came to be. But it obviously is not a scientific description of what occurred, right? And I think with the creation of man and woman, it's a little like that too. And the word that's used for rib is sometimes thought to refer to something else as well. So we don't know for sure. It's like the apple, right? There is nothing in the text that says that Adam and Eve ate an apple from the tree of forbidden fruit. We don't know what the fruit was. So we draw conclusions based upon our understanding of what words mean in the language that we're reading it in, and assume things about the text that may or may not necessarily be true. Yeah, man comes into existence when woman is created. Before that, it's mankind that God made. Right, so God separates the man and the woman into their respective forms, right? So that's an important idea or concept to keep in mind when we read the stories. Yeah, good. Thank you, Keith. Anybody else before we go? Anyone? Neil had to leave, but he expressed his happiness to see everybody. You have a comment?
I do.
Good.
This is Roderick. Hi, everybody. I want to shift the conversation to something in the study today that came a little earlier regarding the 10 Sephirot.
Yeah.
Both in Kabbalah and in a greater way, all of Jewish wisdom imagines these 10 characteristics of how God expresses himself and relates himself to us. And then in turn, they become the 10 powers, as you stated in this study. These 10 have a movement of downward. They flow downward as if humans, men and women, are in a receiving position. We are receptive. So part of what we do is to have an openness and a receptivity to what is flowing to us from God. In contrast, when we think about the philosophies that have influenced Western civilization, the writings and the work of Plato, and Plato conceived humans as people born in a cave, and we, as such, we don't know the truth. We only see the illusions. And so in a quest to move from illusions to truth, we ascend out of the cave somehow towards what he characterizes as the good, the true, and the beautiful, which is an exact opposite flow of the 10 Sephirot. Because from Plato's philosophy and others who come along later after his work, but influenced by that philosophy, because that still continues. That's the bedrock of, we talk about a hierarchical structure, a pyramid structure that's all about ascending, a career ladder, a corporate ladder, a corporate structure. Everything is about ascending higher from the blue-collar workforce to middle management to upper management, trying to get to the top, right? So in contrast to the 10 Sephirot in Jewish wisdom, we have this Western philosophy idea that it's ascending upwards. The flow downward puts us in a receiving position. But from a Greek philosophy or the Platonic idea, it's based upon my efforts to climb, my wisdom, my intellect, my abilities. So when you think about this contrast, Is that all that it is? It's just a contrast. It's a different way of thinking. Is it that one is opposing what God created and put in place? Or is there some kind of aspect where we're both receiving, but we're also responding? And the other, one more thing that I would throw in with this comment is, whenever I'm thinking about that ladder and the flow, I'm thinking of Jacob's dream of a ladder. And in his dream, the messengers of God, the angels, were both descending and ascending.
Yeah.
So there was an up and down flow. So I don't really have a point that I'm making. I'm just reflecting with some comments that create further curiosity for me.
Yeah, good. Yeah, Jacob's ladder is a good illustration to describe what happens in connection with our relationship with God. There is an up and a down, right? And the ladder itself, I mean, Yeshua talks about the ladder too, being the connection between our experience on earth and God's presence. So that ladder is a ladder that we traverse as well. But what's interesting about the comment that Broderick brought up regarding Plato is that it's the diametrically opposed position. I mean, Jewish worldview and the Greek worldview are like polar opposites with regard to the way we think through life, the way life actually works. And I mean, you see this in the writing of what's the guy? Plato's student.
Aristotle,
right. You see this in the writings of Aristotle too, the idea that something is good or beautiful based upon the extent to which it facilitates or accomplishes the objective for which it's been created. You know, so when something does what it's supposed to do, then it's regarded as good or beautiful. And unfortunately, that attitude is something that affects the way many believers feel about themselves and their, you know, and what they've been called to, because none of us are perfect, right? So none of us always act in the ways that we should in different circumstances, right? I mean, there is often a big gap between who we are, our form, and our function, what we're able to accomplish. And we feel if we can't accomplish what we've been called to accomplish, then there must be something wrong with us, right? And it's a big problem. But that comes from Greek philosophy, not from the Bible.
So with that idea, then what is good, true, or beautiful,
right,
is really somewhat based upon expectations and perceptions. So as a parent,
yes,
my wife and I gave birth to children, we raised children. So if I have a perception and an expectation of my sons in one particular direction,
yeah,
and as long as they go in that way because it meets with my perceptions and my expectations, I qualify them as good.
Right.
But if they're not moving in that direction based upon my perceptions and expectations, they're going in a different direction. I have a whole social structure, a political social structure that supports me saying my child is not good. I can take that child to a psychiatrist, or a therapist, a medical doctor, and if they don't meet expectations, then they're not good.
Right.
Not considering the uniqueness of the individual or how certain life exposures and experiences has changed them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So that really, that helps us to better understand why, you know, there have been in former generations where we looked at children that had certain deficiencies, or they were neurologically different, or there was something about them where they were not able to make the benchmark of what was considered healthy, or good, or on target. And that could be with mental health, that could be with physical health, that could be with educational and literary abilities, or cognitive abilities. All of this is based upon baselines, as if everybody can meet the same baselines, right? And we don't know, and it's the differentiation between of where we differ from the baseline that determines whether or not we're good, exceptional, or we're not good. We're either healthy or we're not healthy. That defines the whole Western society. And yet, in God's world, it's a whole different framework.
Right. It's a whole different framework. And the irony is that you take someone like Yeshua. Why was Yeshua referred to as a carpenter?
Because of daddy.
Because his father was a carpenter, right? Why was Joseph a carpenter? Because his father was a carpenter, right? In other words, there weren't the kind of expectations imposed upon children that Roderick just described. That's based upon a Western model, right? In other words, in Jewish thought, what you do for a living is, you know, based upon your skills or abilities and whatever it is that your parent did. But I mean, but the same expectations aren't imposed on a child. In other words, when Yeshua was growing up, you know, his parents didn't ask him, well, do you want to be a musician or do you want to be a carpenter? Right? I mean, there was an expectation that he would do what his father did. That's just the way things work. Right? But that expectation with regard to occupation isn't what was emphasized. Right? What's emphasized is the person's character. Right? That's what people cared more about, what a child was like, what a person does. Well, I don't want to say it's irrelevant, but, you know, but the fact of the matter is that people did what they did in order to make enough money to pay their bills, but that wasn't what their life was about, right? Their life was about whatever investment was being made in their husbands, their wives, their children, their communities, the nation, right? It was the well-being of the community that was important to people, right? So, I mean, I'm sure we all know people who, you know, became a doctor or a lawyer or an Indian chief because that's what their parents wanted for them, and that's what they were willing to pay for, right? So if you go to school and become a doctor, I'll pay for it, right? If you want to be a musician and join a band, then you're going to have to do that on your own because I won't have anything to do with it, right? I mean, that's just the way Western culture works, unfortunately. And it's... I don't think it's it's a part of the thinking that goes into what makes an individual valuable, right? How do we measure a person's worth? And typically it's we determine it by you know, what they do, right? Or, yeah, right, the contribution that they make. But, and But in Jewish thought, that contribution is meaningful too, but it's not a occupation that determines it. It's what the person brings to the community that determines it. Yeah. Very different. See, in our culture in the United States, if you were to ask somebody, you know, who they are, they would respond by telling you what they do. Right?
Yeah.
I'm a teacher, I'm an electrician, I'm a investor, I'm a, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And that is supposed to define, that defines you. Right? But in Jewish thought, that isn't what defines a person. In biblical times, all of the rabbis had an occupation. I mean, but the funny thing is that unless you knew, you would be hard pressed. If I was to ask you, what did Rabbi Akiva do for a living? What did Rabbi Gamliel do for a living? Right? I mean, most people would be hard pressed to answer that question. They have no idea what they did for a living. And I don't even know what some of them did for a living. Because what they did for a living isn't particularly relevant for us. It's how they contributed to my understanding of Torah that's important. And my relationship with God, that's what's important. You know, so it's kind of, the emphasis we put on things is, I would say, misplaced in many ways.
I think, Rabbi, a lot of times, me and Dr. Lowe talk about it, how can you make a contribution to what you do? To yeah. Try to bring them together.
Yes, absolutely.
Because if you ask somebody, you know, they're going to say what they do because that's how they contrive value, right? I'm a doctor, I'm an attorney, you know, I do this, I do that. But then if you say, like with Dr. Logan, he does a lot of things within our community, the Jewish, you know, he a great community, but he also extends his job as a way of how he addresses trauma and how he conveys different techniques and strategies for parents. All those are rooted in the Torah. So, you know, it's always that sweet spot of how do you do what you do,
and
you also bring along the social, you know, spiritual component to try to say, okay, this is what I do, but this is the vehicle I use to express God's truth in my life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, I hope you heard what Mark just expressed. He was talking about the idea of using what it is that you do as a way of serving God or serving others and, you know, bringing a connection.
Right.
But that's what, you know, that's what Paul says when he says, whatever it is that you do, do it all as unto the Lord.
Right.
Right? This idea that we can take even the most mundane activities in our lives and use them as a way to bring blessing to others, right? And that's a connection, an important connection that is consistent with the Jewish worldview or Jewish ideas, right? But yeah, very good. Thank you. Good. Anybody else before we go?
I have a controversial question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you come down here?
Come over here. Hello. So my question is, what are your thoughts about today's transgender movement where there are people that feel like they were born in the wrong body?
Yeah.
And they want to go through and take, you know, like, hormone blockers and go through surgery to change physically who they are. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Okay.
I had to bring that up.
Yeah, no problem. It is a great question. I do have some thoughts on that. First of all, I guess I should say that I think that there is male and female, right? I think there's two genders. But there are people who are sometimes born with more than one pair of parts, right? So that's a part of our reality that we have to kind of live with and come to terms with, the fact that in some cases there might be situations or circumstances in which people feel they're born into the wrong body or not sure whether they're male or female because of whatever combination of parts they have, right? So that's a problem. That's a problem too. The other thing I would say, I don't know if this is or isn't particularly controversial, but I think women ought to participate with other women in sports, in sporting events, and men should participate with other men in sporting events, and biological males should not be allowed to participate in women's sporting events. I think it's unfair, right? So moving past those things, I would say that we have a responsibility to somehow preserve the personal dignity and value of every individual, right? So I don't think that we should, for example, that we should, you know, there have been occasions when someone who is gay is put under a good deal of pressure to try to get them to renounce, you know, their homosexual behavior or tendencies, right? In some cases, it might be possible to determine what it was in their life experiences that triggered that tendency. But I've known others who felt that tendency, that they were born with it, right? That there wasn't a set of experiences, right? So when you say to someone that what it is that they feel deep inside of them is invalid, they have no right to feel that way, that they're going to go to hell because they feel that way, they can't have a relationship with God because they feel that way, in my opinion, that does more damage than good. Right. So in my opinion, do I think that the federal government should pay for sex change operations for prison inmates in our federal prison system? No. I would say no. Right. But does that mean that someone who wants a sex change operation and is willing to pay for it privately doesn't have the right to do it? I would say, you know, I'm not in a position to judge. Right. God is, and he will, is the thing. So I say
if they're an adult.
As an adult, absolutely. Right. Yeah. With regard to children, I agree. Right. I mean, this has been some years ago, but when my kids were in school, you know, you couldn't even give a child a Tylenol without getting parental permission.
Right.
Right. So it doesn't make any sense to me at all that children are, that there is a deliberate attempt to persuade them that they are one thing and not the other. Right? I mean, that seems abusive to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say any underage pressure to pressure a child to be one thing or another is abuse. I would regard that as abusive. Yeah. So I think that probably be better if people minded more of their own business and not so much of others. Right? So, anyway, I hope that was okay. Thank you, Tina. Good. Anybody else before we go? That's, you know, people say that baseball is our national pastime, but it should be redefined, right? Gossip is our national pastime. No problem. Yeah, that's a great observation too, and that's very challenging, right? Because with regard to individuals, there are people, for example, who, because in the case of parental expectations, they yield to parental expectations and they do something that they really don't have a heart for, but they do it because, you know, they want to be okay in the eyes of their parents, right? They want to fulfill the function for which they were created, right? They don't explore other alternatives, something which, you know, might actually make them happy to do, right? I mean, I have no idea, but I'd be interested in knowing what percentage of people actually enjoy what they do for a living, right? When I joined the Marine Corps, I was given a battery of tests, and these tests indicated that I had an aptitude for electrical work. So I became an electrician. I was trained to be an aircraft electrician. And for the 4 years I was in the Marine Corps, I was an aircraft electrician. When I got out, I thought of doing different things, but I ended up working for a friend who was a plumber. And I didn't really care for plumbing, but we were on a job, and the homeowner asked Carl, my friend, if he knew of a good electrician. And he said, Bob's an electrician.
Yeah. Business got started.
And that's how my business got started. Bob's an electrician. Oh, great. This is what we need done. So I made notes on everything he needed to have done. I took them to an electrical supply house, and I talked to the owner of this electrical supply company and said, this is what we need to do. Can you give me everything I need to do it? And, you know, give me some advice with regard to putting it together. And he did. And he mentored me over the next 5 years. And I never would have become the electrician I did without him. And the irony is, I found out later, he's Dutch. And I found out later that his family helped Jews escape the Holocaust. And some of his relatives have trees growing on their behalf at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. He was one of the most wonderful men I have ever known in my life. He was just a great, great guy, and put up with all of the junk, put up with all of my questions and everything. Very patient, and, you know, it was a blessing. It was remarkable. But I have an aptitude for electrical work. I love electrical work. I love wiring homes. You know, it's just, I do it without thinking about it. I just know where things go. I know what goes with what. It's not like I'm not paying attention to what I'm doing, but it's something that came very naturally for me. Right? So, but I didn't grow up in a house. I mean, my family was Jewish, so I didn't grow up in a house without, I mean, this is not true of all Jewish families, but, you know, there was no specific expectations imposed on me. You know, I mean, my parents would have been thrilled with that. It wouldn't have mattered what I was doing. They would have been happy. Right. Well, all except for being a Messianic rabbi, of course. That's not something they would have been thrilled with, but over time, they came to appreciate it.
So is it more of a happy accident that there are a lot of doctors and lawyers who are Jewish?
Yeah.
As opposed to that being expectation from their parents rather than a student?
Yeah, Steve just asked the question, is it a happy coincidence that a lot of doctors and lawyers are Jewish? Or is that based, in some part on parental expectations, right? So it is based in part on parental expectations, right? And you've probably all heard Jewish jokes, about, one, for example, is about a woman who is sitting next to a friend of hers at the inauguration of her son, the President of the United States, right? And the friend says to this woman, what a wonderful thing to share in this event together, the inauguration of your son as the President of the United States. And the mother goes, yeah, but my other son's a doctor. Right. So they're in Jewish families, they tend to emphasize education. Education is a big, big deal, and asking questions is a big, big deal. Last week, when we were talking, I read the story of a scientist, a Nobel Prize winning scientist, who, when he came home from school every day, his mother said, Izzy, what good question did you ask today? Right? So his whole life was based upon asking questions. And so he became a scientist because that's what scientists do. They try to resolve unanswerable questions, right? So these things are kind of connected together, but the emphasis on education, the community, the drive, to invest in people, make a difference in your community, do something that benefits others. That's why there's so many Jewish doctors and lawyers. Yeah.
And comedians.
And, yeah. And Melody said, and comedians. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Very good. Thank you, Steve. Great question. Anybody else before we go? Well, I wish we could do this each week in a different place.
You can go on tour. I was just going to say, Rabbi, right, I got up there, Dr. Logan, I just saw a vision of life.
Yeah.
I did. When you were talking, that you guys go back and forth, it was like a podcast. Nowadays, it's about branding, right? So,
yeah.
A podcast. It was awesome. So I was like, oh, baby. So I've got to have your sidekick,
Yeah, that's right.
That's me.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Mark just made a comment about Roderick and I doing a podcast. Yeah. So I would need to know what that was first, but. Okay. Good. Anybody else before we go? This has been great fun, and it's been nice to see some people I've only seen, on our Zoom studies, and I have to admit it's also nice to be going to the last Giants game of the spring training tomorrow afternoon. So that'll be nice too. Very good. Good to see everybody. God bless you. And we'll see you during the week. Bye for now. Bye for now. I will. Thank you. Very good. Bye for now. Let's see. Okay, how do I...